Good afternoon. So, last time we talked all about how the OS enforces this idea that your programs aren't allowed to do everything, there's these restrictions. And we mentioned that some of these restrictions are kind of configurable, especially for accessing files. And the OS needs a way of deciding what programs can access this file and things like that. We talk about our primary mechanism for that. So we had one side where we need to say, well, we have to kind of mark programs based on what things they're allowed to access. And the most common way we do that is we associate every program with user and group ID. So we say, we're not going to have each program have a list of all the files it can access. That's a thing we could do, but that's not generally not how this what we choose. Instead, we say a program is associated with a particular user, which usually means a person, or a particular group, which usually means kind of a group of users, like all students. And the OS tracks this for every program that's running. And then we have this thing we call an access control list. So alongside things like files, we have a list of who's allowed to access them that uses these user and group IDs. And basically, when you try to access the file, the OS checks what user ID and what group ID is this, what's the access control list, kind of sees if they match up, and if they do, it allows you to do it, otherwise it says no. And it turns out, as we'll discuss today, you have to go through the OS to do things like accessing files, so there's no real way around this. And we said that we have these kind of two styles of access control list on Unix-like systems. So we have kind of our very limited portable style with chmod. And we have these more general access control lists, which you see on some Unix systems. We'll use some of them in our lab on Wednesday. And also they're kind of what Windows has in general, where we can have as many users and groups in that list as we want. Then we talked about, we have some things that need, where we have programs that need to be able to have special access to the system. How, for example, do we have programs that run as a different user, like programs that let me log in? And we could imagine this being kind of a special case in the OS, but usually we don't have the OS have special support for displaying a login box. Instead, we have a program do that. Maybe how can we do that? Well, we have a special user on which always has permission to do things. It still goes through the OS, but when the OS says, can you open this file, it says, if you're this special user, you can. I'm not going to care what the access control list says. I'm just going to ignore that because you're this special user. And this sort of allows us to have things which can access special functionality, like changing users or accessing things like shutting down the machine, which we probably don't want, at least in a machine like Portal, to let everyone do. And we also mentioned, that handles why can the thing I'm booting up the machine into log in as anyone? What user doesn't have to do that? But it doesn't answer how some tools we might use, like sudo, if you've used, which allows people who are system administrators to get access to the super user functionality when they don't start a super user, or other tools which let normal users shut down the machine, but only some of them, things like that. How can we do that? One way is we could imagine modifying the OS to selectively give you these extra permissions, but a more common approach, at least on Unix-like systems, is that we have some programs that are marked to be allowed to run with special access. So even though you're running them, they get to run as typically super user, so they are able to pass all these permission checks about can you shut down the machine and so on. And the idea is that whoever installed these programs and marked them as getting special access carefully made sure, or had someone else carefully make sure, that they only allow users to do the right thing. So if it shuts down the machine, it has the right checks before doing that to make sure it's okay to shut down the machine at this point in time. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
You said that in the POSIX system, user always overrides group. Is that basically going to be true with all the systems we're working with and supports, or are there other groups?
So the POSIX system.
User always
overrides. So I guess.
Like permissions?
Root always overrides permissions. So in the systems we're used to, in most Unix-like systems, Linux or other similar systems, or in fact most systems I'm aware of, not all of them, but most of the time things are configured such that there's a special user called root or system or something like that, where when the OS needs to check, are you allowed to do this thing, it just says yes. It is possible to have systems where there's no such user, and you could imagine from a security point of view, that might be a thing you might want to do. You might want to say, once the system gets booted, no one should be able to touch this without like rebooting the whole thing and start booting something else. But that's not a very common configuration. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Do user permissions always override group permissions in all the systems we're looking at in this class?
Do user permissions always override group permissions in all the systems we're looking at? I don't know. On Unix, I think that's the case in all relevant cases, but I'm not 100% sure. And it turns out that the POSIX standards are deliberately vague about this, because there are systems out there which have kind of other ways of giving you or taking away your permissions.
Gotcha. Thank you.
There's things that aren't access control lists for controlling what files you can access that some systems implement that we haven't talked about, but they're out there. And because of that, all the standards aren't going to say, this definitely gives you access or definitely doesn't. They're going to leave it up to other things the system might be doing to support the system administrator setting up, having more options, basically, than just access control lists. Yeah?
So just to specify, the AI you just said, suppose we have user A and then group B. If user A have only the reading access to a certain file, and group B has both reading and writing access to a file, to the same file, and if we add user A to group B, does he automatically get your writing access at all?
So if we add, so the saying is that if a user has only reading access to a file, and they're part of, but we have a program that they're running as part of a group that has read and write access, do they get both read and write access? Yeah, so I'm actually not sure how that works with chmod. I think they get both accesses with chmod style permissions. With access control lists, they definitely, if there's an explicit entry for the user, it overrides the group permissions. That is definitely true for access control lists. I'm not sure how it works with chmod. I would assume you get the better permissions, basically. Yeah. Sorry, you wouldn't often see
a user in a group and just the user overrides a group permissions.
You wouldn't often see a user in a group if the user overrides a group permission. I wouldn't say that. I guess it's uncommon to see cases where people are deliberately having a group that a user is a part of have more access than the user does in an access control list. But the semantics are that if the user has settings for a file in an access in a the full access control list, user settings override the group ones, and if you want to do that. And for chmod, I'm not sure what happens, and it might even vary. I would assume you just get more the extra permissions, though. I would say this is not a common scenario for chmod style permissions, because if you're the owner of the file, you can just change those permissions. So it usually doesn't come up that you have less permissions than the group has. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry, I just wanted to confirm that. So if a user, the user doesn't have certain permissions, but they belong to a group that does have those permissions, the user permissions will take precedence, and so the user won't have the permissions that belong to the group.
So the question, if a user doesn't have certain permissions, but they belong to a group that has permissions, the user permissions will take precedent. So if there is for the full access control list, if there's an explicit entry saying this user doesn't have permissions, so if someone wrote in the access control list, user foo like this, saying foo doesn't have permissions. If someone wrote that in the access control list, that will take precedence. In a case where this just happens because the user's not mentioned at all, the group permissions are going to win, because there's no user to match over them. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so want to remind people that, as has been on the schedule this whole semester, the warm-up assignment is due on Friday. So if you haven't started it, now would be a great time, or yesterday would be a great time. I probably should, I looked at sort of the quiz, and I probably should talk about some of the quiz questions. So we'll start with question one. So question one, we had the scenario where an existing executable broke when a dynamically linked library, a .so, a shared object file, was updated. So what was happening here is that we had this executable that when we started it, it loaded this dynamically linked libraries code from that .so file, and that code was no longer compatible with the code in the executable. And the reason this happened is because we had a function that expected an int. So they expected a double now, but previously expected an int. And the way we call functions that expect a double uses different registers than the way we call functions that expect an int. So we weren't actually passing the right parameters to the function. And we asked what things would avoid or fix this problem. And the first option a lot of people have problems with is that if the library was a .a instead of a .so. So in this case, we make the executable. All the code in the .a file goes into the executable. We have to do this because when we run the program, it doesn't read the code out from another file, so it must be in the executable. And that means that if we just update the .a file, well, that's not automatically going to update our executable, and our executable, if we don't do anything, will still have the old library code, the one that calls foo with an int and has a foo that expects an int. So things will just work until we try to relink things. Another option given was, what if bar.h has both prototypes? So there's two ways we can look at this. So one is that the way C works is you aren't allowed to have a function with two different prototypes. It's not allowed. Now, some of you might be familiar with languages where this is allowed. So C++ is probably the most prominent example. In those sorts of languages, we need to define both versions of the function. So just changing the .h file to add another declaration is not going to be enough to do that. We also need to define the foo taking an int and a foo taking a double both in our implementation. So questions on question one? Yes. So your question is, if I'm calling foo like foo of one, like why isn't that compatible when it takes a double? And the issue is that you're talking about, one converts to 1.0 implicitly. So it does this, but this is something the compiler handles at compile time. So when we compile this and it calls foo int, so if this calls foo int, we're gonna do something like move one into RDI and call foo. If this calls foo of double, we're going to move the encoding of 1.0, whatever, if you have to remember your CSO1 stuff and how floating point works to figure what that is. But basically, we're going to, I should clean this up. So we're going to take, we're going to move, and this is sort of the, this is 1.0. in IEEE format into, it turns out, a register called XMM0, and then call foo. Right. So this is very, even though this is a promotion, the way it happens is the compiler takes care of the fact that one converts to the double value when it's making the assembly. So if we've already made the assembly, it's too late for it to fix that based on foo changing. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there?
So you wouldn't have to make other go into the .c files as well and change it to the
Question, I wouldn't have to manually go into the .b files to change it. So because there is an implicit conversion from int to double, it should just work. The compiler should implement that conversion itself based on knowing, oh, I have to call this function that takes a double. Here's an integer. How do I do that? Well, first I convert the integer to a double. And that's just how the compiler works normally. Like if you think of like the pow function, for example, like takes doubles or floats and what you can call it, looking like integers in the compiler just handles that automatically, that should happen in this case. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question, if the original was double, we changed it, none of these would work. So it depends on what our actual calls to foo look like. But if we had foo of 1.0, that would be a type error. And it wouldn't compile again. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there.
So what's the convention for where you put function prototypes? Is it always going to be in the library, or are they also sometimes?
Question, where do I put function prototypes? Generally, we put them in .h files. So maybe something which is a little confusing terminology-wise here is that we usually think of a library as kind of .a or .so file and the corresponding .h files. But the library file is just the .a or .so file, the stuff with the code. But I would say we put it in the .h files, and that's kind of, when we're distributing the library for someone to use it, we definitely give them the .h files along with it. You know, any .a or .so files. Does that answer your question? Sorry? Question, I would never put a prototype in the top of a C file. I would only do that if I only expect that function to be used in the current C file. And in that case, I would probably mark it as static. Things will function if you put the prototype manually in the top of .c files, because the way like including a .h file works is it's basically copying the .h file there. So instead of using .h files at all, you could just write all the prototypes from the other files in the top of every .c file. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just assumed it'd be both places, I guess, in my mind. You know,
so question, you said it'd be both places. So as long as you're including the .h file, you take care of having it available. That's going to be enough. Yes?
Well, I guess I kind of got through the question with that thing. So, like, if you, let's say I have my .h file, and, if you have a C file, and it includes the .h file, if you didn't include the .h file, but the .h file wasn't in the library, will it still work?
So question, will things still work if I don't include the .h file? The short answer is no. The slightly longer answer, I guess there's kind of two things, right? You could just take what's in the .h file and manually put that in your C file without including anything, right? Like you could put the int foo int or whatever in your .c file instead of including the .h file. And as long as that matches what the function actually is, things will still work. Also, for horrible historical reasons, C has rules about what it expects functions to look like if there's no prototype for them. So when you call a function that isn't declared, sometimes you will only get a warning, and it will make up a prototype for you, and you better hope that's the right one. I would recommend turning that warning into an error, or at least treating it like an error, because this is obviously very error-prone. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we had question two, which was about an erroneous makefile. And the problem with this makefile is I had a bunch of rules that referenced .c files when I meant to reference the object files. So I have these rules where I gave a command that runs a compiler with -e, which produces a .o file, but I'm telling make, this is how you update the C file. So I meant to write, this is how you update the .o file. I also had a rule for making the executable, but I told make to run a command where the compiler is going to read the C files and compile them and then link them together to make the executable. So even though I'm making these .o files, I told the compiler not to use them. I'm telling it to work directly from the original C files instead. And even though I did that, I had these dependencies that kind of implied that I wanted the .o files made. In fact, because of how my rules work, you know, if I'm asking to build executable, it's going to say, well, I need to make foo.c up to date. If it says, oh, foo.c versus foo.h is not up to date, it's going to run that command, which happens to update foo.o, actually. But make doesn't know that. It's just going to run the command when the times say it should. So questions about sort of what was wrong with the make file in the question? So then we had sort of different scenarios. So if we, let's say if foo.h is more recent than main.c and foo.c, should have this be and foo.c, then we would, the rakefile rules would say to that, oh, main.c and foo.c are out of date. So we're going to run the commands to update foo.h and foo.o and main.o. And then we're going to check, oh, is main.c newer than the executable? Is foo.c newer than the executable? And because that command we ran didn't actually change main.c or foo.c, the answer could be no. And if foo.c or main.c are more recent than the executable, we're going to run the command to build the executable. So sometimes we actually will update the executable, but we're not going to do so from the .o files. And in this process, if both of these are true, we could compile main.c to make main.o, and then compile main.c again to put it into the executable, not using that .o file we just made. Next questions? Yes.
So the main.o and foo.o will be unmapped from the
main.o.
The .o file will be unmapped from the main.c.
The .o file will be.
Although it's not in the make file, but it will be automatically built.
Question: the .o file will be built, although it's not in the make file. Yes, and that's because, even though make doesn't know about the .o files, you know, it's going to run this command, and running this command makes foo.o. And it's going to run that command based on foo.c and foo.h, but it's not checking whether the command actually does. It just says, you told me this command is for foo.c and foo.h. Does that answer your question? Question, the executable we built based on the .c files instead of the .o files? Yes, and that's just because the command we gave uses the .c files, and that's how the compiler works. The compiler looks at the files you actually tell it about on the command line. So it doesn't check for the .o files being in the same directory, it just says, you told me foo.c, that's what I'm reading.
But I remember in the side mentioned that we have to go from the .c file to the .o file and then build the
So question, I mentioned in the slides, we have to build from the .c to the .o files and then build the executable files. So that is the process. So what this command here that we erroneously said, which starts with the .c files, will do, is the compiler still makes the .o files, but it makes them in a temporary directory. So it's going to happen under the hood, but because we told the compiler, go from .c to executable, it's going to make the .o files somewhere for temporarily, just so it can do the work, rather than using any copy we have in the current directory.
So the executable file still can be built based on the .c file?
So the question is, the executable file can still be built based on the .c file? Yes, because the compiler can handle the steps of making a .o file as it needs to.
Thank you.
Yes? Question, would it also compile foo.c twice? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so then question three. We have this scenario where I gave you this process of taking an SVG file and converting it to a header file with a nice array we could use of the data in bitmap format. And we ran this xfxd command, and we asked you to fill in the rule that would be above it. And we wanted to say the target is the file would write, and we told you XSD would write logo.h. And the prerequisites are all the things it's reading to do that, and it's going to read logo.bmp. We don't put logo.svg here because that's going to be specified by a different rule. And make's going to handle, oh, I need to make logo.bmp. How do I do that? First, I make logo.svg. Questions? There. Yes?
On the second part, when you're doing the rule for main.o, why is it not appropriate to include main.c?
Why is it not appropriate to include main.c? It is fine, it is okay to include main.c. This is my slide on that. But it's not needed because the wildcard rule that takes .o to .c to .o handles it already. So I will give credit if you wrote main.c, but it's not necessary because of the other rule that's there that's going to combine with our main.o rule to make that work. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is that a general make file thing then, where if you have like two definitions of the requirements of a file, it will just
is that a general thing that makefile will combine sort of two rules for the same target? Yes. Yeah.
For the previous point, with the conversion, with suffix rules, why would that not work?
Why would a suffix rule not work? So you're saying, could I have a suffix rule that does .bmp.h? You could, but the command we have for that rule, the command we have pre-written there was not correct for that because it needs to handle arbitrary files, not just logo. Right, because the suffix rule says anything.bmp to anything.h, but the command we wrote only handles logo.bmp and logo.h.
Even if it's the only conversion between the two?
So I guess it would technically work if it's the only conversion that we're ever doing, and maybe we probably should give you some credit for that, but like, it's bad for the future, because if you ever do another conversion, you have the wrong command now. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank
you.
Yeah? It says logo.h is included by main.c, so it's graphics that is, so why are those, why do you need them?
Why do you need them there as the part of the rule? So they're included by main.c, therefore they're used when we build main.o. We need them in the rule because make doesn't read main.c. We have to tell it what it includes in order for it to figure out that, oh, when we're making main.o, the compiler is going to read main.c and these .h files. And it needs to know that because, for example, if we don't do anything, logo.h won't exist. And that compilation will just fail. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, why is graphics.h sort of a dependency of two different .o files? Because graphics.h is used by main.c and graphics.c. Therefore, when we compile main.c or graphics.c, the compiler also reads graphics.h. But what we're passing to the compiler is based on our sort of, based on this rule. The command we're running is from the .o to .c rule, so .c to .o rule. And that command says we should just pass the C file. So we're only compiling main.c and graphics.c, we just have these prerequisites of the .h files to let make know that, hey, what that compilation does depends on what's in these .h files, so make sure you pay attention if someone edits graphics.h. So as an example, let's say graphics.h might have like a struct definition. If we change that, we need to recompile everything that uses that. And this sort of rule is going to let us do that. So if graphics.h changes, we in fact do want to recompile main.c and graphics.c, therefore updating main.o and graphics.o, just in case we made some big change to it, like changing what a struct looks like, the order of a struct. Yeah?
So with graphics.o, like, why is it then put into the executable?
Question is, what is graphics.o then? So I guess graphics.o comes from this rule. So actually, graphics.o comes from graphics.c. The graphics.h is an extra dependency. So when you combine those rules together, we have a rule like graphics.o colon graphics.c graphics.h, and then we run GCC or Clang for that together. But we're only running it on the .c file. Does that make sense? So I think what's confusing is I don't think I mentioned graphics.c explicitly, but graphics.c is what we'll actually build because the command is based on this .c to .o rule. That's the only thing specifying a command to run, so the command we're running is going to assume the .c file is there. Does that answer your question? Yes? Question, if we edit graphics.h, would the command we run be from the .o.c rule? Yes.
Okay.
Because that's the only command specified, right? The other rules were just specifying prerequisites. They didn't specify additional commands. So the only way they're going to do anything is when they get combined with that .o.c rule. Yeah?
Is it standard for standard libraries that you
Is it standard for standard libraries that you don't include in the main files? That is usually what you do. If you do include them, they aren't in the current directory, so you can't just write standard.io.h. Make's going to look for, if you type edit standard.io.h, it's not there, right? It's in another place. So you need to specify where they actually are installed, which is not going to be your current directory.
Right. More generally, we can assume that they're never going to change. Right?
Question, more generally, we can assume they're never going to change. Usually, that's what makefiles do in practice. Obviously, it's not 100% true.
Standard libraries.
The standard libraries, people assume they aren't going to change, but obviously they do sometimes.
Okay.
You upgrade your system, the standard library changes. Other questions? Okay, and finally, question 6, asking about we wanted two files, one that A and B could access and one that A and C could access. So group with A lets us do this by having the files owned by B and C. This is with chmod style permissions and writable by the group with A and the owner. And the group with B and C, group with B and group with C lets us do this by having both files owned by A and writable by either the group with just B or the group with just C. Questions come up with that. Okay. Yes, sorry. Question, for the first scenario, the group with A scenario, would A have to actually be in an independent group? Yes, because the way chmod style permissions work, or we can only specify a group ID in that sort of second slot. So with the full access control list, like you'll use in the lab tomorrow, you don't have to worry about that because you can just list as many users as you like. Not true with chmod style permissions. There's no slot. The slot for a group only accepts groups. Yeah?
So for the case of group A is the only member in that group, but it's owned by both B and C.
Question, for the case where we're using group A is the only member of the group, but it's owned by B and C. So we have a separate file for B's comments and C's comments that are owned by B and C respectively. Does that answer your question? Yes?
So we're
Question, would I also be able to change individual user permissions? So with chmod style permissions, I can only set permissions for one user at a time. So the problem is that I have two users I want to set permissions for, so the only way I could do that is by having, like, I could change the file, who owns the file over time, but I can't have it at one time accessible to both users without some group stuff involved. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What's the difference between having a file with B only? Question, isn't this just the same as, oh, so is this the same as denying all permissions to user C? So in the problem setup, we said no one else should have access. So an important part of that is that if we have like users D, E, and F, they also shouldn't have access. So I can't, so it wouldn't be sufficient to just say deny user C access to do that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Like in terms of the problem, it says that like I want to collect comments from collaborator students B and C. And I feel like whenever we like talked to the previous classes, they've always heard that like collaborators are people who help you, not the file. So I'm just like wondering
So the question is, why did the problem set up not have BNC be able to share things?
No, I'm saying, like, I feel like in every, you know, like in our CS classes, we've always said that, like, collaborators are people who help, they're not, like, the file owner. So I'm just confused.
So the question is, why would the file owner be a collaborator instead of A?
Yeah.
That's, all right, so when you're setting up permissions, often you'll set up what, so the question was asking, how can we set up this type of access, not, like, what makes the most sense given the social situation? And so, like, there's, and a way that's pretty practical is if you want to work with B, you say, B, set up something for me to use. And, like, that's what we'd be imagining in the scenario with a group of A. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so get to our main topic. So we talked about permissions, now we're going to talk about what's going on under the hood. And we learned that, oh, you should be able to read others' files. So how does that actually happen? And this creates a little problem, that we want the hardware in the OS to collectively allow you to read your own files from the hard drive, but not read other people's. Let's say if you're connected to a system or we have a hard drive directly connected which has those files. So how can we do this? And I'll give you some options. So one option is that before running your program, the OS could tell the hardware, here are the parts of the hard drive this program can access. You enforce that, they only access that part. This is something we could do, but it's actually not very practical in practice because sort of this requires us somehow to communicate with the hardware, what files does this user have permission for? We learned that permissions have all these nice complicated settings. It's actually very inconvenient to do that, so most of the time you will not see this strategy used. Though you could do it, and in simpler scenarios, maybe we'd do something like this. Like, if the simpler scenario would be, let's say you're running a VM that has access to, like, 10 gigabytes of a hard drive, maybe we could do it for that, not for individual files, probably. Another strategy is that we could have your program have checks to see, do I actually have permission to access this file? And before your OS runs your program, it makes sure you have all those checks in the right place and only runs your program if you have included those checks. And if you haven't, it just says, sorry, can't run this executable, it's malformed. This is, again, a real strategy. And it's attractive because it requires no work for the hardware. We can just not change the hardware at all. But it's generally not done in practice. I mean, the biggest problem is that to support this kind of verification, we probably need to compile the program in a very special way to allow the OS to check, oh, where are all the places this program might access a file? Let's see that, make sure all those places have the right check. Like, that's something possible, but it's not not going to support the kind of way we're used to compiling programs. So the solution that we'll actually use in practice is that the OS is going to tell the hardware to only allow OS written code to access the hard drive. So you might say, well, but my program needs to access the hard drive. So when your program wants to do that, you're going to somehow trigger the OS written code to run, and the OS written code is going to have the right checks to make sure the access is okay. So this is the solution we'll use in practice. So it's simpler for the hardware than my first proposal, but more complicated than the second one. And it's pretty simple for the OS. The OS probably needs code to access the hard drive anyways, just needs to add a few checks to it. So how do we have this enforcement that only the OS code can do this? So what are we going to add to the hardware for that? And what we're going to add is we're going to add this extra one bit the hardware will track for everything that's running, which is going to be, are we in what's called kernel mode? I'm going to use the name kernel mode. If you're reading things elsewhere, you might hear other names for this mode, like privilege mode or supervisor mode. Basically, kernel mode is this one bit, and if it's true, we have extra access to the machine. If it's false, we don't. And the idea is only the OS code gets to run in kernel mode. Everything else runs in what we call user mode. And an example of an operation we'll only allow in kernel mode is talking to any input-output device. So how is kernel mode going to work? Well, when we boot the system, we're going to start in kernel mode, running the OS, presumably, because that's what we expect to run after boot. And when the OS runs normal programs, it's going to switch back to user mode. Now, a piece we're missing here is how do we switch back to kernel mode? Because if I switch to user mode, I can't access the disk anymore. I need to somehow get back to kernel mode to actually do that. Because if you said that's how we're enforcing that only the OS written code, the only code we're going to allow to run in kernel mode, does things like access our hard drive. And the answer is going to be something we'll call a system call that we'll talk about in a bit. Yes?
So it switches to user mode just like by default when you go to log in, I guess?
Question, it switches to user mode by default when you go to log in? So basically, anytime we're running a normal process's code, I should say, will always be in user mode. No exceptions. Only when we're running OS code will we ever be in kernel mode. That answer your question? So this is going to kind of give us this picture of how our programs are going to work. That my programs and their libraries are going to kind of sit on top of the user mode interface to the hardware, which is going to be more limited than the full one. So it doesn't have access to like talk to a hard drive. But I'm also going to have this interface with the OS that runs in kernel mode, we'll call a system call interface. So I have some way of making a request to the OS saying, like, hey, read this file for me. And the kernel, which is what we'll call the part of the OS that runs in kernel mode, has access to the complete hardware interface, which lets it talk to the hard drive and things like that. Questions about part of my diagram of sort of the layers of interfaces we have? Yes? Go ahead.
What can the user mode interface do?
Question, what can the user mode interface do? So the user mode interface has all the registers, it can do math, it can access pointers, all the things you're used to doing in assembly. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but not like I/O.
But not like I/O, etc. Exactly. Other questions? Okay. So we have this idea of a system call. So how does that work? And the simplest idea might be, I said call, so you might have an idea this is going to be like a function call, and it is. And maybe you say, maybe this could really be a function call. So we'll have our program code, and we'll just have it call a function in the OS that function will do what we want. But we need to be a little more careful than that. So if I think of my OS, probably I have the routine we want the program to call that reads a file and checks the permissions. Probably we also have some code that just reads from the disk without checking permissions, just because that's how we're going to write the code, right? We're going to have that function. We want it to be possible for the program to call this nice read function, but not this dangerous read function. So for that reason, we're not just going to give the program the ability to call something in the OS's code. It's going to have to be more restrictive than that. So the mechanism we're going to use is that we're going to have some special instruction the program runs to make a system call. And the idea of this is similar to a call instruction, but rather than jumping to a particular location the instruction specifies, it's going to go to a location the OS decided on at boot. So this is going to have one place that handles system calls, and that code, you know, is not going to be changeable when the program's running. It's going to be something only kernel mode can change. And that's where this system call instruction is going to go. And so you might say, we have one location. Well, how does that work? We have lots of things we want to do when we ask the OS to do things. So the code at that location is going to figure out what the program wants to do. And you might say, how are we going to know that? Well, just like with a function call, we figure out what the thing that's calling our function wants to do by looking at the arguments, which are typically in registers. Same idea here. So the OS is going to look at the registers the program set, figure out what is the program actually asking me to do. That's going to include, is it asking me to like read from a hard drive or open a network socket? But it's going to look at those registers just like a function would look at its arguments through registers in sort of a normal assembly function call. And this code is going to have to be written to be safe. It has to check, you know, is this program's request actually something I want to do, right? So if the program asks to open a file, it needs to check, is that file actually something that the access control lists say it can access? And so on. So kind of the timeline we'll have is that we'll be running in user mode. This is the program's code. So here is the program code. And on the other side is the OS code. We're running in user mode. The program's going to encode its request in the registers. It's going to make this special instruction to trigger a system call. We're going to go to the handler that was set up at boot. That handler's going to read those registers and decode what was the program asking to do and do something about it, which maybe is doing the request. Maybe it's returning an error saying, no, you can't do that. But it's going to do something about that. And in the common case, go back to the user code. As we'll learn later, it doesn't have to do that. So you can go somewhere, do something else instead. So questions about this timeline here? OK, so I'd like to mention one thing about terminology here. I'm going to use the phrase system call. And this has a little bit of ambiguity that I'd like to just mention explicitly so I don't get in trouble. So sometimes when I say system call, I mean just the triggering of that running the OS. And sometimes when people say system call, they mean the whole process of running the OS and handling that whole request. This is the same kind of thing which happens with a function call. If I say make a function call, sometimes you think of the function call as just that call, like the call instruction. Sometimes you think of it as the whole time the function's running. We have that same kind of sort of two uses of the term call for system calls. Questions? Terminology? Yes. Question, does the type of the system call have its own register? So how the system call arguments work is up to the OS. And it's a convention. So just like we have a calling convention for normal functions, we'll have a calling convention for the system calls, and typically that will specify we'll use this register for this thing and so on. And as a very concrete example, on Linux, this convention is that the register RIX is used to specify what you want to do, and the registers RDI, RSI, and so on are used to specify the parameters for that operation.
Okay.
Other questions? Yeah. Question can answer, kernel mode is kind of analogous to having access to a file, but instead we have access to hardware. That's one way of thinking about it. So code running in kernel mode is allowed to do the hardware, allowed by the hardware to directly access extra things, like the hard drive and other things we'll talk about. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned that one of the things the system call needs to do is it needs to check like whether the program is allowed to leave the file before doing it. And we mentioned with access control list, the way this works is that like it looks at the user ID and the group ID, compares it to the access control list, says yes or no. And we learned that the user ID was kind of stored in the OS's memory, like it tracks when your program's running, what's its user ID, what's its group IDs. So I'm saying, which of these alternatives would still be okay? And by authorization checks, I mean, you know, is current program allowed to access a file? So that's comparing the user and group IDs to the access control list. And I guess something else which comes up is that when you're accessing these system functionality, typically you don't make a system call directly. Instead, you call a standard library function that makes a system call. Like you call fopen or open, and those make a system call for you. So our standard library is where the code that makes a system call in a typical program would be.
So
yeah.
When you say that standard library is the code that makes the system calls, you mean everything in the standard library is code?
Question, I mean everything in the standard library is code that makes system call? No. But for example, there's a bunch of standard library functions that access a file. It needs to use system calls to do that. System call is that request to the OS to run its handler in kernel mode that will do something for you.
This,
the function call-ish thing to the OS, yeah.
It's like
Who'd like some more time? Seeing many. Okay, so who thinks A would still be secure? Okay, a bunch of people. Who thinks B would still be secure? Who thinks C would still be secure? Who has no clue? Okay, a few people. Okay, so something I guess I should reorder, put this later, I guess, because we'll talk later, but most of the time when you make a system call, you don't write the actual assembly instructions to make a system call, you call a library function to do it. And it's easy to get into kind of the complacency that that means that, you know, as long as that code does the right checks, we're okay. And there's two big problems with that, and the big reason why B is false. So one is that I can make my own version of the standard library that doesn't have these checks, make it a .a file, link against it instead of the standard library, and boom, my code now doesn't check whether I have permission to access things. So that makes B unacceptable. A is fine, it's still secure, because we're doing two checks. And the only one that matters is the one in the system call handler, the one that the OS controls the code for and won't change, no matter what the program does. So it's still secure, it's just redundant work. So we won't do it in practice. So if you look at the code in the standard library, it doesn't like check, can I open this file? It just tries to open it. Because there's no sense in checking, it's just a waste of time. We're gonna check anyways. And option C is the one that's kind of tempting. So we learn that the OS needs to store user IDs, and they might say, let's be clever and not store the user IDs. We can just track that in, say, the library and pass it. The problem is I can replace the library with one which passes whatever user ID I want. Right? If it's an argument, I can change the code that makes the system call to change those arguments. Like, maybe I can't do this using the normal standard library, but I can make my own version of libc.a and statically link my program, and there I'm using a different version of that code. Other questions about this? Yes?
What's the answer?
I think A would still be secure, and none of the others. Yes?
Can I go over C again?
So probably the intention of C is, oh, it's really annoying that the OS has to track these user and group IDs. Let's just have the program track it for us and pass it to the OS. The problem with that is that I can control that code because I can replace my standard library with whatever code I want, and it can track the user ID incorrectly. It can say, I'm always super user.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there. What does the standard library refer to? That refers to generally the C standard library. When I say it, I basically mean any library that's linked into your program without you explicitly asking for it. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, is the system call function of the standard library? Yes, we'll go into more detail as our next topic about how that works. Other questions? Okay, so let's go through. I'm gonna give as an example of how system calls work on 64-bit x86 Linux. Obviously, other OSs and other architectures will not be the same because I'm gonna be showing assembly code, but in 64-bit, x86 Linux, there's a special instruction in x86 64 called syscall. And that's the one that actually triggers that OS handler to run. And we have to pass arguments though, so we're gonna set some registers before we make that instruction, just like you'd set registers before making a normal function call. And on Linux, they've just decided this convention that RAX has the system call number, which is what to do, what operation. So for example, there's a number for read, for write, for open, for connect, like over the network, and a whole bunch of other operations. And then we use RDI RSI as arguments similar to a function call's arguments. And when the syscall goes back to your program, what Linux has decided is that the operating system will modify RAX to contain the result of that operation in a particular format, where negative numbers indicate something went wrong. And so with this, I can write something. Here's, I have a hello world program that doesn't rely on any libraries. So I've done a few weird things because it doesn't rely on any libraries. So one weird thing is that I'm starting at underscore start and not main. And that's because the way main works in C on Linux typically is that there's actually some compiler written code that's kind of part of the standard library that calls main. So here, I'm not using the standard library at all or any libraries. So I'm writing the code that runs first rather than having something call me and having done some setup first. The reason the library code calls main instead of main starting directly is that we like need to do some things to make like printf work and things like that. And then I'm going to make two system calls, and we have the code above that sets the arguments to the system calls. And my two system calls are identified by the type of operation in RAX. So I have this first line, which moves one into RAX. If you remember, our AT&T syntax assembly is source destination. And one is the number that Linux has chosen for write. And I specify where to write. I use one, which means standard out. And then I specify what to write and how big it is. So I'm saying I'm writing 15 characters. It comes from that string that I've defined in this assembly. So that's the write operation. And then I call the exit system call. You might say, wait, exit's a system call? Well, yes, because what we're asking you to do when we exit is run some other program. And that's not something I can do directly because I don't have access to other programs in my program. So I have to ask the OS for help with that. Questions about this assembly? Yeah?
Can you just repeat that last part about needing help from the OS?
Your question, can I repeat the last part about why exit is a system call?
Yeah.
So when our program exits, we need to have some other program run. And usually, we don't have access to all the other programs on the system. So in order to exit, I need to ask for help from the OS. I don't have permission to like figure out to run other programs directly. I have to have the OS help me with that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So question, what if I got rid of these lines here? So in that case, the way assembly machine code works, right? We'd fetch the next bytes of machine code, which would be whatever's in memory after that last syscall instruction. And if we're lucky, that will be, when we interpret that as machine code, it will crash our program. If we're unlucky, it won't crash our program, and something, our program will do something. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, do compilers automatically place these sort of exit system call into our code? No, but I mentioned that when we write main, right, some code calls main. So when we return from main, you go back to that code, and that code will contain something like this. So instead of adding this to your code directly, the compilers call your function, your main, and the code that calls main has code like this to handle it when main returns. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, there's one copy of all the US code and all the users have equal access to it, essentially? Yes. That's at least in the sort of standard Unix / Linux design. Not all OSs work that way, but that's kind of how Unix Linux works. Yeah?
Is the code for the exit code like an arbitrary number that you choose?
Question, is the exit code an arbitrary number that you choose? The exit code is an arbitrary number that the Linux developers chose. Mostly how this worked is that they basically assign these numbers sequentially, and every time they add a new one, they just take the next number. And it turns out there were multiple versions of XSet, so that's how, so there's an older one which is like a lower number, but the current, the one you want to use now has number 60. Yes?
Why are we setting RDI to 0?
Why are we setting RDI to 0? So the XSet system call takes an argument, which is the XSet status, and this is something that the program that was running you can retrieve to figure out did you succeed or not. So we have to supply something for that argument, and I chose 0. That answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there.
What's the purpose of moving
0
to RDI?
What's the purpose of moving 0 to RDI? This is, as mentioned in the previous question, we're supplying the argument 0 to the XSet system call. That's going to be used to tell the program that ran us did we succeed or not. And I'm just arbitrarily telling it 0, which usually is interpreted as this program ran successfully. Yes?
Sorry if this is a dumb question, but like, whenever you say return 0, is that the same as like moving that into RDI, or why would you not be moving 0 to RDI?
Question, when I say return 0, is that the same as moving that to RDI? So I guess this here, basically this is kind of like calling XSet of 0, if you know the XSet function in the C standard library. And the 0 there is something that's going to be given to the program that's running us. It's commonly called the return value or status, but it's not a return value in like in a function call sense. Yes, Becker?
Can you explain what the syscall does in both cases?
Can I explain what the syscall does in both cases? So this syscall, it's gonna jump to OS code, and in that OS code, we're basically gonna have a switch on RAX with cases for, you know, each of the possible things you could put in RAX. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
Permission checking is going to be inside the OS code.
Permission checking is going to be inside the OS code? Yes. So any permission checking is going to happen in these sort of individual cases for the different operations we could choose. Yeah?
So does RDI go from a file descriptor to like kind of determining whether it ran successfully or not?
So the question is, RDI like have different meanings for the different system calls? Yes. So because we can specify all different kinds of operations depending on what RAX is, what RDI, RSI, and so on will mean varies all over the place. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And yeah, so Linux has a whole bunch of system calls. I showed you kind of write and XSet or XSet group, and there's a whole bunch of other ones that you'll see. Now, something, and yeah, I showed you actually write and write, not read. Something I should mention, that's why I highlight these. So some of these system calls don't work kind of like normal function calls in the sense that they don't return, or don't return right away. So if I make an XSet call, I expect that never to return, just like the XSet function in the C library. And if I call read, I do expect that to return, but if I have to wait to like get input, like let's say, you know, I'm asking for input from the keyboard and I just walked away from the machine, we expect the OS to do other things for a while. So something that we'll find out is that when the system call, when we make a system call, like say to read from the keyboard, you know, the OS might, while we're handling that, it might do something else in the middle of it. It doesn't have to keep working on our system call. And that's something it can do because the people who wrote the OS wrote that code can do whatever it likes. And when I make sort of my XSet call, right, it does that same idea, do something else for a while, just never goes back. And that's something the code can do because, you know, we're just running that code, it doesn't need to actually return. Questions? Back there, yes.
So like, if for this thing here, if I do start typing, then will it return?
Like, sorry, I messed up the slide. So this was for the read key press, but for XSet program, it wouldn't do that.
Oh, okay.
I need to remove that from, need to avoid. avoid duplicating certain things on my slides. Other questions? Okay, so one thing you may have noticed is that you looked at my code that makes system calls, and I wrote it in assembly, and I had to write it in assembly, because I can't just write the syscall instruction in C. But that's not what a function call does. A call makes the call instruction. And it's actually pretty common that you'll want to make a system call from C. So how do we do that? So one way is that we could write some assembly function that does the work for us. And it turns out that the standard library authors have done that for us. So on Linux, the standard library has a function called open in it. And the function called open is basically written in assembly and looks something like this. What does it do? It sets RAX, the system call number, to 2, which happens to be what open is assigned to, and then runs the system call handler instruction. And Linux has carefully set up how system calls work, so RDI and RSI are the two arguments to open, the file name and the whether you want to open it for reading or writing. And that means that when that system call runs, it's going to set RAX, it's going to say, oh, this is an open operation. It's going to look at RDI, and it's going to say, that's whatever you pass to this open function from C. And so the idea is that this sort of function is going to allow us to kind of treat this function as if it were the system call. It's not really, but it's what's called a system call wrapper. So you might have code which uses this. So for example, here's some code which you could run on Linux that uses the sort of lowest level interface, not fopen, but something that's harder to use and I don't recommend. But this is what fopen uses internally. And it calls this open function, and that makes a system call, like, and that's basically all the function does. So these are called system call wrappers. And the main reason I'm mentioning them is, well, to know how do you make system calls. So this is one way, how you can do it practically in C. The other is that commonly people will say, oh, open is a system call. And that's not quite correct, right? It's a system call wrapper. You aren't literally making a system call by just calling open. You're making it because open's a function that makes a system call. Questions on this system call wrapper? Yes, back there. Question, is system call wrapper a trap? We will talk about exceptions later. The system call wrapper makes a system call because it runs this special instruction, and you'll see things call that a trap, as we'll discuss later when we talk about other things that run the OS. But it runs the OS not because the call, it's not because running open does it, not because calling open does it, but because open contains code that runs the OS. Other questions? Okay, and so I showed you kind of the system calls, sort of how we conventionally do it from C, and there's a tool that you can use on Linux machines and maybe on Portal that will trace system calls. So this is a debugging tool that can like show you what system calls a program makes. So for example, I have the Hello World program I showed earlier, the one that I wrote in assembly. And if I run it with strace, it produces a file trace.txt in this the way I wrote it, invoked it, and that shows me all the system calls it made. So we first have this call that was requesting to actually run the Hello World program. Then we see the two calls my Hello World program ran. So this is a debugging tool, but it's showing the system calls in the format you'd call for the system call wrapper. Now, if you run this on a real program, you'll see that the standard library actually makes a lot more system calls than you might expect, because it's setting up a lot of stuff to make printf and other things work, and also because of dynamic linking and things like that. So you can see here that we have this whole bunch of other things happening. And that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk a little more about this and then go on to what about times when the OS needs to run when the program doesn't request it.